The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Welcome to the Space Show, everybody, and you are listening to our Sunday program, and I am your host, David Livingston. The recordings on our laptop don't seem to be playing correctly, but this is our Sunday program, California time at noon, and we have another excellent program for you with 2 guests today, Jay Whitner, who I'll introduce in just a minute, and Ron Jones with the Integrated Space Plan. First, a couple of our usual announcements. First of all, our toll-free number for those of you who would like to call us and talk to our 2 guests is 1-866-687-7223. And remember, there are no call screeners, so be patient, let the phone ring, and we will bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And then, in addition, you can do email drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then you can also use our blog to send us notes. So to do that, it is thespaceshow.com. All the way over to the far right is the upcoming show menu. And this is the first show listed. So remember, this is also our blog and archive page. So open it up, scroll all the way down to the bottom where you would normally make your blog comments, and post your question or comments for our guest. And I will get them almost immediately and can integrate them into our discussion. The preferred way, of course, to communicate with our guest is our toll-free number, and we certainly do hope that you will use that. And that, again, is 1-866-7223. And then, of course, the second preferred way is email with drspace@thespaceshow.com. So do remember that after today's program, we will post our website newsletter, which has all of the programs planned for the coming week. Plus, it shows you what we have planned for coming weeks through into the end of the year. We're already booking shows toward the end of the year. I'm kind of surprised at that. The year does seem to be traveling very, very fast. And we love guest suggestions, so if you do have some, send me the details and why you think the person would make a great Space Show guest, and please use email for that, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do remember that everything we do is archived, so you can quickly download programs or easily listen to them off of our website. In the upper left menu, there is a store under support for those of you interested in Space Show logo wear and items of that nature. And then there is a listen live button. We hope you will share this information. It tells listeners how to listen to our program. So it tells you how to listen to live programming because all of it's on the internet. Our podcasts, which are on various servers, including iTunes and TuneIn, including Alexa. And TuneIn is embedded on our website. And then, of course, our other podcasting servers that are listed there as well. So if you have any questions, email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Feel free to share that information, and we certainly support it. Remember, the Space Show is a listener-supported program. We are a nonprofit 501c3 with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and we appreciate your support. It does keep us on the air. And if you look on our homepage, you'll see support information for both using PayPal as well as sending in contributions by check for those of you who don't like to do things with PayPal. And in addition, you will find Amazon programs. They have 2 fabulous programs for supporting nonprofits, and One Giant Leap Foundation is registered with Amazon as a nonprofit. And we thank those of you who do your routine shopping through the One Giant Leap portal or through their SMILE website, which is a clone of their regular website, except there everything that is purchased gets a percentage taken off for the nonprofit that you've chosen, and One Giant Leap is one of the nonprofits that are listed that you can choose. So we thank Jeff and Amazon for some truly great programming assistance for nonprofits. And if you have any questions about how to support the space show, please check out our 501c3, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Remember, you get a tax deduction if you're a federal U.S. taxpayer and a California tax deduction if you're a California taxpayer. And email me for more questions, drspace@thespaceshow.com. We also have sponsors for our space show program. Our guests today are a sponsor, so let me just briefly mention the sponsorship program. You get a banner ad going across the website. You can change that banner as often as you like. And for most of the full-length programs, you do get a message read supporting what it is that you do and that you want us to talk about. On the shorter programs, 60 minutes or less, we just simply read the sponsor messages. But today, since the Integrated Space Program is the feature of our program, and they are a terrific sponsor, and you should check them out at thespaceplan.com, but you'll hear more about that in a minute, I just want to thank all of our sponsors for being with us today, as because they're all very, very important to us. So that includes Northrop Grumman, AIAA, Celestis, the Space Development Network, the National Space Society, and the Space Foundation, as well as the Integrated Space Plan. And therefore, I want to introduce Jay Whitner to us, and he is the president of Integrated Space Analytics, and they're the company that is behind the Integrated Space Plan. And he's a founding partner of the Space Finance Group and is currently involved and deeply committed and serving on the National Space Society's Board of Directors. You should read his entire bio. It is on the website for you to read, but also joined with him is Ron Jones, a partner with Space Systems Loral, and he's a lead with the Integrated Space Analytics Company, recently created to update and automate the Integrated Space Plan. He's also the marketing director for Biospace Experiments, which provide low-cost turnkey access to space for microgravity researchers. His bio is in full and also on the website, and you should check it out as well. But as I always say, it's much more fun to talk to our guests than to read about them. So Jay and Ron, welcome back to the Space Show. It's nice to have you both as guests again. Ron, starting out with you, because we always do have very new listeners to the Space Show, and they may not be as familiar with the Space Plan as others, even though I read your sponsorship message all the time. Give us the 101 intro to the Space Plan.
Sure. Well, the Integrated Space Plan was something that I worked on just years ago now. God, we're getting old. Back in the 80s when I worked at Rockwell International. It was my attempt to pull together a systematic overview of the entire space program, an integrated approach. You know, I was fortunate enough at the time to work in the Advanced Projects Group at Rockwell. We were just starting work on the early days of the Space Exploration Initiative under George Bush 41. I'd been thinking about this for quite a while, and when I got to Rockwell, I had all access to all these old studies that had been done in the aerospace industry, for the, you know, all the proposals on the, lunar missions and I had a bunch of old Wernher von Braun studies they had in the files back there. So it seemed like a good time to start working on this. So what the Integrated Space Plan is was an attempt to pull together all the missions and the goals and the emerging technologies in a systematic, chronological way to show how humanity can expand into space. Way back in the 80s, you know, we had the main effort was the space shuttle, And I looked about 100 years into the future through, eventually we're going to go back to the moon and on to Mars and develop space settlements. I'd been in a space since a young age and really got turned on by the idea of space settlements in my teens. And so I'd been thinking about this stuff for quite a while. But what kind of confused me is how do we get to where we were way back then to where we want to go? So what are all the things you have to put together? You know, what are all the technologies that have to be developed? So that was the basic idea of the integrated space plan, putting it all together in a logical, rational, long-range, not a plan, but a set of objectives to kind of get to where we'd like to go, but through many different routes. So that was basically what the integrated space plan was. Now, it kind of, like I said, it started in my 20s. I spent my 20s, I was a space cadet in California, and we spent the early years forming groups, space groups in California. And so at that time, I got really into the space shuttle. We were talking about the space shuttle, how it was going to, launch things for $300 a pound and change the world as we know it in space. And I got really involved early on the uses of the external tank in space, how we can turn this huge volume into a space station. And as luck would have it, in the early 80s, I ended up down at Vandenberg Air Force Base working for the military space shuttle for Martin Marietta, who built the external tank. And so I started taking advantage of those that information that was suddenly at my fingertips. And the one thing I noticed in the 80s, mid-80s, working down at Vandenberg, was I was working with all these young people my age in their mid-early 20s, late 20s, that knew nothing about how Vandenberg fit into the broader scheme of things. And so that's what really got me kind of turned on about this idea of putting together a broad picture that shows, like, how does Vandenberg fit in? What is all this effort going on down there? How does it fit into the bigger long-range picture? So after Challenger exploded, everything came to a screeching halt, and we all got laid off within a few months. Vandenberg, the Air Force, pulled out of manned space, and I found myself in Hawaii drinking a lot of chi-chis and beer and just thinking about things. And that's when the actual idea for the integrated space plan that you'll be hearing about was actually born on a beach in Hawaii after Challenger exploded. I had a few drinks, and I just came up with the approach to kind of phase, depict all these different elements in a way that made rational sense to me. And when I finally got back to work again after Challenger, I ended up, went back to work for Rockwell International to build a follow-on to Challenger, the Endeavor. And somehow during in that effort, I got made it into the Advanced Projects Group. Actually, it was because of the Integrated Space Plan. That's another story, but because I'd been working on it on the side. And so that's pretty much how it happened. And it's been a living thing ever since.
So I have a question for you, which is, hopefully we can take a few minutes of our time today to do this. So I initially met you years and years and years ago, and listeners, the very first Space Plan Space Show ever done was maybe in the first year of the Space Show, going back 16 or 17 years ago with Ron. And I met you with Declan, and then, for those of you who don't know, Declan, who has passed away, is Declan O'Donnell, who was a brilliant tax attorney out of Castle Rock, California, very active in National Space Society at the time, and very prominent as a space advocate, space attorney with lots of different opinions. He was instrumental in my doctoral decision work. And Ron, I met you with him. And then at the time, I think you were with Boeing, not with Rockwell. You had moved, maybe the merger had taken place. And you did a space plan program almost at the birth of the space show. So so that was like very early in the days of the space plan, and you created that on the aftermath of Challenger when you had gotten laid off and you were in Hawaii, and then you came back to Rockwell. Were you still with Rockwell at the time, or had you actually transferred over to Boeing?
No, I had to have been at Rockwell. Boeing didn't happen till quite a bit later. Actually, Boeing happened around, well, see, when 9/11 happened, I had just started for Boeing. So
okay, so I get things clouded going that far.
Yeah,
back
I think
in time.
It is pretty cloudy back there.
And you know, the space plan at the time was very, very innovative, and I remember you sent me sort of a laminated version of that very early space plan that you used to bring to meetings with Declan that a lot of people at the time did attend. I used to fly in from California to attend those meetings. And I would imagine with Jay and you, the space plan is pretty different from what you did back in the day when you first started out, correct?
Yeah, there was a when Jay first got a hold of me and said, "Hey, let's revise this thing." It was about 25 years after I created it, and Jay had a little team put together, and they wanted to bring it up to date. It's a very complex thing, and the software that I initially developed it on, you know, they don't even make it anymore, I don't think, and to recreate it was going to be a major effort that I just wasn't ready to do, and Jay said, I got these computers, ours, and we can do it. And we ended up in I was 2013. I guess we did the Kickstarter. 2014, we were locked up in a room in a resort in the Caribbean and going over the old plan, looking at all the stuff that had passed, you know, and either made it, you know, or stuff that never happened. And we looked at all the things we were talking about then, 4 or 5 years ago, and started putting that stuff on there. And anyway, so we've hopefully scaled that back a little bit from them. I think at one point we had 500 or 600 elements on the integrated space plan. Jay, I forget, but I know we don't have that on there now.
Yeah, we actually had too many. We had, I think it was 600 or so, and it just was unmanageable. So we ended up having to trim it down to roughly 400 elements, given the limitations of a physical poster. But I well remember at the first National Space Society ISDC conference that I ever attended, there was Ron with the integrated space plan back from those days, and I was just blown away at what a cool idea it was.
May '89, I think that was when I introduced it to the world.
Yeah, a detailed flowchart covering, you know, roughly 100 years into the future of what needs to happen and when it needs to happen, sort of putting it all in order and showing people how it all links together. And like Ron said, you know, it had been dormant for a while, and I talked with Ron and some guys that I've been working with about updating the thing. So we did a couple of Kickstarters to do the update. And the current version that we have right now, the 2017 version, is the second of the new versions that we've put together. And also we brought the plan online for the first time, because back when Ron first did it, there wasn't really an internet. So there wasn't really an online situation for anything, so it was never widely distributed. Basically, you know, to get one, you almost had to see Ron at the space conference back in the old days. So now it's online, and that's actually what today's show is about primarily, is we have a new website for the project that we'll be talking about today.
Terrific. And, you have brought it modern and made tons of changes in it, because I did go back and listen to that initial show way back when I first met you with Declan years and years ago. A lot of things have happened. How would you guys grade your forecasting, if that's a good way to say it? Are we collectively as a space industry moving toward many of the options and pathways that you suggest as possibilities for becoming space-faring? Do you think we're making progress creeping and crawling, or we're somehow sidetracked or going the wrong way? What do you guys think of your wisdom?
Where we are is, at least in terms of the new plan, you know, we created it recently enough that it's not, you know, hasn't veered too far away from the plan, because, you know, we only did the most recent one last year. So, but yeah, things are in a rapid state of flux. And I guess it's largely due to Mr. Musk and what SpaceX has been doing. But, for example, the 2017 plan that we had, we locked down all the content. Maybe it was 3 or 4 weeks before Elon Musk made his big Australia announcement about the BFR. So, you know, you have events like that, and it's certainly a very challenging project that's not yet come to fruition, but Elon has a very good track record of pulling off what he's aiming at. So, for example, if that becomes reality, it's going to transform, at least in my opinion, you know, the entire plan if that comes out. So we'll see over the next couple of years if BFR is on track, and there's very good signs in the last couple of weeks. Rex is very confident.
You know, he's making a press announcement tomorrow. I have a show during it, so I was unable to sign up and attend. And he's using the BFR, and he's going to name his tourist who's going to use it to go circle around the moon. And it's a press conference that he's holding to make all of this clear. And my assumption is he's naming the tourist who wants to go around the moon, and he's using the BFR to do it. And I forget what date he said they were shooting for in the press release, and I don't have it in front of me. But yeah, if he pulls that off within a year or two and actually makes it, I think that'll be a huge change in the industry.
Well, yeah, I just think that the reason I think they're very confident is there was no compelling reason that they had to make that announcement. So to me, what it really means is right now SpaceX is very confident that the BFR is going to work out.
Absolutely. He wouldn't make that without some level of knowing that that's a real announcement. He wouldn't just do it for rhetoric like some other companies have done. So you may have to come up with a new version.
Well, we're going to integrate that into it, certainly, and that could really change, you know, the way we do things in developing cislunar space. You know, there's competing, there's a lot of talk now about how are we going to develop cislunar space. You know, what are we going to do with the lunar gateway? Are we going to develop lunar gateway? A lot of people think, you know, that's just another obstacle to get to, if you want to go to the moon, why bother building a gateway? You know, and talking to Buzz, you know, Buzz would rather, you know, he's one of the guys that wants to see the lunar gateway go away because he'd like to see his, you know, lunar cycler happen. Well, I don't know of anybody working on a lunar cycler. Oh, what's this? Musk. He comes. His BFR, well, geez, that has all the makings of what could be a cycler, you know, especially if you, you know, use it that way. So, yeah, predicting the future is very hard. I learned this, David. It's even if you're semi-psychic, it's tough. You know, there's just so many things that just come up that you can't possibly plan for. When I originally did the integrated space plan, you know, we didn't foresee the astronomical cost of space shuttle operations. We thought it was going to be cheap. You know, well, that changed everything. And we didn't realize how risk-averse the industry was, you know, or at least I didn't. And that affected the way things developed. And then what amazed me when I, in around the late 80s, when Buzz and I were in Washington, D.C., trying to sell a Star Booster reusable first stage concept, I couldn't possibly have imagined that the aerospace institutions would be so opposed to reusability. You know, it wasn't until Musk came along that now he has forced the big aerospace companies into reusable systems. But 20 years ago, you thought that was the next logical thing to happen, but boy, you couldn't convince them to give up their single expendable rockets that they can get $60 million a crack for.
I have an email from a listener. This is the first one. This is from Kathy, and Kathy is in Billings, Montana. And she says, when you started the space plan, or when you started revising it, was there a push on for humans to go to Mars, anything like there is today? I know the private sector didn't exist the way it does today, but what about a push to Mars for humans, and how has that impacted paths that lead to the ultimate goals talked about with the space plan?
Well, there was a talk about going to Mars. This is in the time frame of the first President George Bush's Space Exploration Initiative. And if you'll recall, way back then, we wanted to go to Mars, but we wanted to go to, we were kind of zeroing in on going to Mars via the moon, setting up a moon base, mining materials on the moon. We thought there'd be, even way back then, we kind of suspected there was going to be water on the moon. And even way back then, we were thinking about mining that water, making propellant, using that propellant to go to Mars. Well, NASA put together a long-range plan to do all this called the 90-Day Study. Came out around 89 time frame, I think, or 90. And basically they said, yeah, we can do all this for something approaching $1 trillion. Like, I think it was like $900 billion in change. And that's what killed the whole effort, was the huge cost of going to Mars via the moon. You know, and that's what got guys like Bob Zubrin all turned on, you know, to go to Mars direct. Why do you want to go to the moon if if you want to go to Mars, go to Mars. Why put obstacles in front of you that cost a lot? So, yeah, we were thinking about Mars. And now the funny thing is, today we're thinking the same thing, and we're thinking it in the same way. Except now we're living in the era of the COTS, and the lower cost way to do it. You know, we developed the CST-100 and the Dragon, much lower cost. They're different contractual mechanisms than our early space programs. So the thinking is, NASA's hoping that we could do all this stuff for a fraction of the cost, like a tenth the cost. So if we can develop our cislunar architecture, tap into the resources of the moon and near-Earth asteroids at one-tenth the cost we would have done it 20 years ago, well, all of a sudden that makes going to the moon and going on to Mars and tapping into those lunar resources a lot more, the cost much more palatable. So that's what we're kind of looking at today. Again, that we just got to do it. We're going to do it cheaper and smarter.
Are there key pivot points in the space plan that have to happen? Otherwise, there are huge setbacks. Do you have to cross some kind of bridge successfully, reach some threshold? Are there trigger points going forward?
It's all about reusability. You know, we need to develop launch systems that are reusable. And Elon Musk and Blue Origin, it's happening. You know, and that's forcing the Boeings and Lockheed Martins, and ULA, they're developing reusable systems. So it's happening. Once we have a suite of reusable vehicles, I think all the things that we talked about that we saw 25 years ago, they're going to happen just late. Would you agree, Jay?
Well, Hunt is mentioning about the reusable vehicles. That's clearly critical technology, but also, and anybody that wants to follow along could be looking at the website that we have that would help them sort of see what we're talking about, which, again, is thespaceplan.com. But the center column of the plan is called the critical path. So really part of the answer, I think, to the question is, could you do a big space plan without the things listed in the critical path? And I think it'd be extremely difficult to try to do that. You know, to develop space, you know, we're going to need a presence on the moon. Eventually, we're going to need a presence on Mars. Well, there are, in my view anyway, critical pieces that it'd be very hard to do without, and sort of it breaks down into bases and reusable vehicles like Ron was talking about. And in fact, it's a little bit interesting, but there may be sort of a merger going on between reusable vehicles and bases, given some of the comments by SpaceX about sort of positioning a BFR on Mars for extended time to serve as like the seed of the base. so the BFR upper stage might turn out to be some of these bases.
Does the space plan focus mostly on United States effort, or does it take into consideration that maybe Russia, ESA, China, India, or some other country or group can move the ball forward?
Well, I would say that the plan does have somewhat of an American focus, but all the countries you just mentioned have elements on the plan. Certainly, Russia has been a major space player for a long time, and followed by China, and then Japan, and India, and other places. So, yeah, there's elements on the plan from pretty much all the spacefaring nations, but we are we're the leader, frankly, in terms of the amount of resources we're deploying, and we have SpaceX, and they don't. So there is a certain amount of American focus in the plan, but it is international. Ron, would you agree with that characterization?
Yeah, I think the center line of the space plan are, and the whole thrust of the space program is human, of the integrated space plan from day one has been human expansion into space. And, you know, America has pretty much led that. I mean, we've got some stiff competition from the Russians. But when it came down to developing the first space plan, the center line was really basically what are those things that the U.S. budget is focusing on, NASA's budget. You know, so, you know, at first it was, well, in the early days of the plan was a space shuttle. And so all the effort to develop all the elements around the space shuttle and leading to the space station, and that was the next big effort. We used the shuttle to build the space station. Now we're looking at whether we go to the moon or Mars. The moon or Mars aren't going to move. They're always going to be out there. So they're on the space plan, I think, you know, pretty much forever. Now, we've always had a Lagrange point, not Lagrange point, a lunar gateway on the space plan. You know, we've talked about that for a long time also. And now it's been justified in recent years for different reasons, you know, or, the, you know, even though U.S. would rather go to Mars, the Europeans have never been to the moon, and we want to help them get to the moon, so our way of helping them is developing this gateway, and they can operate their robotics from the gateway while we can use it for maybe as a staging, you know, area for further Mars operations, that type of thing. So we're looking for ways to kind of cooperate with everybody, and so all the key international projects are on there, but the main focus is pretty much the near-term things that the U.S. is spending money on in the near term. And in the far term, the focus has always been developing human communities in space, you know, for millions, tens of thousands, millions of people. How do we get there? And so that's pretty much the longer-range thing. I don't know if other countries, by the time we develop the infrastructure in the next 50 years, if they're going to be able to go off and develop their own. You know, more power to them. They can develop their own space plans. But right now, we've tried to incorporate all these different diverse international activities on there that support our main thrust of human expansion in the space.
I have another email for either of you or both of you if you want to comment. This is Rodney, and he says he's listening live in the UK. And he says, for some of us outside the United States, perhaps we have a different perspective. For example, we're getting lots of press here, maybe you are there too, about the strange behavior of Mr. Musk. I'm wondering if your space plan takes into consideration that SpaceX is driven by one personality, strange may he be, and what would SpaceX's contribution be to the space plan if somehow Mr. Musk was incapacitated, stroked out, or no longer available to lead the company and bring his vision to the table? Are you really basing all of the space plan on the future of what one person does? I'm not even sure SpaceX would be led the same way if Mr. Musk was not available to lead it.
Well, we're certainly not basing the entire integrated space plan on what any one person is doing. But at the same time, some people are more influential than others. And today in the space world, Mr. Musk is about as influential as you get.
Number one, yes.
If for some reason something, God forbid, happened to Mr. Musk, that would be a tragedy. But I would hope that Glenn Shotwell and the leadership at SpaceX would continue along on this path, because it's clear that they're doing important work. You know, all you have to do is watch a launch with the live coverage of the team there at SpaceX headquarters. They're all emotionally involved with what they're doing. So it's my hope that the team would rally around and continue with the work of SpaceX, even if for some reason Mr. Musk was unavailable.
By the way, Rodney, that comes up on the space show from time to time, mostly on open line show. People ask that kind of a question. Of course, I have no good answer for it other than the way Jay answered it. But
yeah.
There's not a lot of information that would point to anything on that question. Go ahead. What
yeah.
were you going to say?
This is Ron.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking the Integrated Space Plan has always been a compilation of many different sources from many different people. And we don't even have BFR on it yet, as Jay was saying. You know, it's, but I think we've got the evolution of the Falcon rocket on there, and that's had such a profound influence on lowering the cost to orbit. And it would be a real shame if something happened to SpaceX and they went away, but I think the genie is out of the bottle now as far as reusability goes. I think Mr. Musk has proven that you can get to space a lot cheaper if you want to. And now we've got Mr. Bezos, you know, doing the same thing. And soon we'll be seeing a reusable first stage with the XS-1 that Boeing's building and the Vulcan. I think reusability is here to stay, and the lower cost to get to space are here to stay, irrespective of what happens to Mr. Musk, although I certainly hope he survives.
He survives and flourishes.
Yeah, really.
Absolutely.
There is a lot of cislunar interest today, so I just did a show with Dallas Benhoff, who both of you probably know, and he's retired out of Boeing and has started a cislunar private company based on finding commercial markets and customers. He also talks about the ULA cislunar 1000 plan and others. So, and of course, he's looking for lower costs to the moon and for cislunar travel between Earth and the moon. Is that identified specifically, cislunar transportation on the space plan, or is it integrated into the plan in a more general way? Because there is, I'm noticing, a really increased focus on developing a commercial cislunar economic system.
Well, it's really interesting, David, that and it's encouraging to us to see like what the cislunar 1000 people are talking about really parallels quite closely, you know, what we've been talking about ourselves. And also, I liked hearing what Dallas had to say, and I also saw a lot of interaction between that and our plan. But yeah, we have a reusable in-space transportation infrastructure as part of the Integrated Space Plan. And that also ties in with our new NASA Administrator, Mr. Bridenstine, about he'd like to see everything reusable basically between here and the moon. And that's where we've been going all along just for cost reasons and efficiency. There's no reason that a transportation device that goes from LEO to L1 can't be flown a whole bunch of times. We need to get away from this one-use paradigm.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure we've got all the most of the elements from the CST or from the ULA's architecture on the Integrated Space Plan. And
well,
Dallas, you know,
that
Dallas
that
has been
a smart element for their plan, but that's just a point of view.
Say it again, one at a time.
I would say that they have most of our elements reflected in their plan. That's just the point of view.
Well, okay. That's, you can say however you want, but I know when we were putting it together, I was making sure a lot of the key stuff was addressed. So I, Yes, the answer is we have addressed a lot of the cislunar architecture, and it will change over the next few years. Especially if SpaceX wants to play a role in cislunar or lunar activities, which they've said they want to do. So that's going to probably change the architecture some more. So in fact, I think when we do revise the integrated space plan again, we're going to make sure we've captured, but pay special attention to the next, 25, 30 years, especially in the area of cislunar development. We've got things. We've got all the elements out there and the fuel depots and all that kind of stuff we're going to need. But hopefully things will be looking a little more clearer as time goes on.
People can buy a copy of the plan. What do they get when they buy it? Do they get what we see on your website? Is the home version something different?
Well, if someone orders a copy of the poster, it looks the same as the plan you see on our website for the most part. But if you go to our website page, you see sort of the core timeline. The poster that you get has a lot of peripheral information around the edges that's quite useful. It's so much data you can't see it really on a computer screen. Most of the information is depicted in various places on our website, and it looks like we'll be talking about the new website probably in the second half of the program. But what they get in the poster, the adult poster has a lot of great information regarding our space future. And last year we came out with a new poster product that's the student version of the integrated space plan that has the same sort of a timeline, but it's simplified so that students can really grasp it and interact with it more easily. So instead of having 400 elements on it, there's like 100 elements on it. So we have two different plans that are available online. You can get either one. You can get packages with both of them or sets of them, like if you have a National Space Society chapter or something. And you can also buy large versions that you sometimes see at space conferences. Those are available for sale also.
Can you get a subscription so you automatically get updated when you have a new one come out?
Hey, good idea.
That's a good idea, but we do not. We've not offered that so far. Maybe we'll need to consider that moving forward.
Well, how often do you plan on updating it? It's about every 2 years.
We've been on a 2 year cycle, which is kind of interesting because it means that our next update would coincide with the 50-year Apollo 11 anniversary. So we're trying to put together some special new things for that. Yeah, the next time frame would be this coming year. We'd have a new version.
Well, you ought to think about a subscription so you get a better deal than buying two separate ones, and you get money in advance. So,
money in advance is great.
So just a thought. Do you have? We are getting close to our break point, but do you have planetary science and exploration listed like New Horizons? I'm just pulling something out of the ether to Pluto and beyond. Is that part of facilitating our going into space with people?
Well, we've broadened Ron's original concept for the integrated space plan. Always had some things beyond the human program, but it was more of a human space travel, a human space exploration focus. We've broadened that a little bit in the recent versions of the integrated space plan, and so we have a little bit more of the robotic exploration type of things in there. So yes, we've got the big observatories, we've got things like New Horizons, so we're trying to show at least the really big and important pieces of space exploration and development, even if they're not necessarily directly human exploration.
We are at the halfway point, so I think I will go ahead and take our break. Listeners, you can give us a call. I can't believe you are not listening to the show rather than at work, so you should have the toll-free line available. 1-866-687-7223. We do take calls during the break as well. And give us about 3 minutes, and we will be back with our two guests. So don't go anyplace and stand by. We are definitely coming back. Lots more to talk about.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Sunday program. We're talking about the Integrated Space Plan with Jay Whitner and Ron Jones. And remember, our toll-free number, if you would like to give us a call, is 1-866-687-7223. We will continue taking your emails at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And you can also post a question or comment for us on our blog. If you need instructions for that, email me. Jay, the website is thespaceplan.com, and it's a new website and new layout, new design, new color. Talk to us about your website changes for the Space Plan.
Great. That's the big thing that we wanted to make sure everybody was aware of for the show. Is that we do have a brand new website, and I want to thank the guy who did the heavy lifting on this version of the website, which is Michael Mealing. We are greatly appreciative of all the work that he's put in to help us have a new look and some new functionality on our website. So anybody that wants to be looking at the website while I try to describe a few of the features, it's thespaceplan.com. That's what you'd want to type into your browser to get to the website. So if someone goes there, the home page has the plan itself. That's the core of Integrated Space Analytics is the Integrated Space Plan, so that's what you see first. And if people do not have a computer handy, it's a long-term flow chart of our future in space. There's a dozen columns of information that represent the types of things. And it runs out roughly 100 years in the future. And there's all these rectangular blocks on the Integrated Space Plan with descriptions of what the things are. So you can tell what type of thing it is by the column that it's located in and by the vertical positioning, what year we anticipate that it's going to happen. And it's an interactive situation, so people can click on one of the elements. And then a box opens with more information about the element with text, sometimes videos about it. And while not every single element right now has additional information, most of them do. And we're in the process of reconnecting a couple of links that didn't survive the website transition. But in addition to the Integrated Space Plan itself, there's three sort of drop-down menus right above it. One is a glossary that explains some of the acronyms that are there. There's one that has a pull-down that shows you the Lagrange points where they're located in our Earth-Moon system. And there's a diagram that talks about the delta V, so in maneuvering around the solar system, how much energy does it take to transition from one position to another. There is a pull-down menu at the top for the shop, which came up earlier in the show, that people can buy space plans. That's where you would go if you want to get your own personal copy of the plan. But we do offer it for free worldwide on the Internet. Anybody that wants to look at it, you know, there's no charge certainly to do that. There's a pull-down menu that talks about the plan, and there's information in there about launch vehicles, spaceports. There's also information about people who've sponsored our plan. We've had some corporate sponsorship, I guess, like David, perhaps. But our sponsors, the main ones are 212 Box out in New York, and Entrescan, and Scandi, and the National Space Society, and the Space Finance Group, and Extraordinary Innovative Space Partnerships, and IDIYA. All those are sort of mentioned there on our plan with links to those companies. And there is a list of contributors, both of ideas to the Integrated Space Plan and people who've contributed funds to the Kickstarter so that we were able to do all this. Then there's general information about us and our advisors and our mission and stuff. So our team is a half a dozen people. We can't have a half a dozen people on a space show program. It's just too cumbersome. So in addition to Ron and I, there's also Gary Bickford and Steven Jorgensen and Michael Mealing and Josh Powers. And we also have a very nice advisory group that helps us when we do the heavy lifting to do an update of the plan. So all those people are listed there on our website as well.
And you mentioned Dallas earlier. Dallas is on our advisory group.
Yeah. I guess, I'll just go through them real quick. Dallas, Eric Clough, Anita Gale, Rich Godwin, Kirby Eichen, John Mankins, Tom Olson, Bruce Pittman, Seth Potter, and Dennis Wingo. I think roughly half of them have been Space Show guests at one time or another. And we don't bother all the advisors too often, but as I said, when we go to do our big updates every other year, we circulate that to all the advisors and ask for any suggestions they have for timing or adding different things to the plan or maybe taking something off. So we give them the opportunity to weigh in on the contents. And also we have sort of informal advisors, perhaps, that are not on that list that also, you know, look at what we do every year and provide their input. We have Space Headlines. It's a quick video recap of what goes on in space each week, usually 6 or 7 minutes long, people can look at. We have another link to get the poster. And then at the upper right-hand corner of the homepage, there's the Amazon Smile thing, like David has. So anybody that wants to buy Amazon stuff, our nonprofit gets, I'm not even sure what we get out of it. I mean, like 1% or something, but every little bit helps. Then there's a pull-down menu called Fun Stuff, and we have a collection of space movies in there if people are looking for a new movie to look at, and there's also a listing of space books there. And we have our student edition, which you can actually see in two places right now on our website. The one on the right has the clickable links on it, and the one on the left has some of the icons on it. We're still sort of building up the beautification version of the clickable website for the student plan. But overall, it's a very clean, modern look to the new website that we have. And I also want to tip my hat to the guy who made our first website, Gary Bickford. And it was very advanced and had just tremendous capabilities in what we had. But it was a lot of heavy lifting more because it was a more complex back office in the original site. And over time, our team has gotten involved with so many different space organizations that we're stretched kind of thin. And this new website, we think, will be simpler to operate. And I was looking at it the other day. We're involved with 10 different space organizations, our team of a half a dozen. So we do all kinds of different things in the space community. But that's sort of a quick overview of the Integrated Space Plan website. And overall, one of the things about the plan is it's the expansion of humanity and sort of harvesting the resources of the solar system. What are the resources in space? What products can we make out of the resources in space? And who are the customers for those products? And over time, we think that the Integrated Space Plan is the answers to those sorts of things. Because as we move out into the solar system, different resources become available. Different infrastructure is needed to harvest the resources, to convert them into products, and then figure out which of these other elements are users of those products. So there's really an ecosystem out there that the Integrated Space Plan is sort of a depiction of that, and that's part of our future plans for development of the website.
You have an email from Carl in Sacramento, and he says, the space plan is comprehensive. I've been looking at it, and I think it would be very helpful to people charged with making space policy. Do you know if you get it into the hands of members of Congress or their staff or other people involved in policy like the National Space Council?
We have in the past, earlier versions of the plan, Ron, I guess, Ron, were you hand-delivering those on the Hill, or were you sending and mailing them? How were you doing that?
Well, I remember when we first came out with it, I got a letter from the guy who at the time was the head of the Space Caucus on the Hill. And I think his name was Brown. Congressman Brown, does that ring a bell?
Well, there used to be a Harold Brown years and years
ago. Not Harold Brown. It'll come to me later. But, yeah, I sent a couple hundred of them off to the Hill. And in the early days, we used to hand-walk it around the offices on the Hill to educate senators and congressmen and staffers. I know one of my real early supporters was Lori Garver when she was head of NSS, and she used to take it with her all the time. So, yeah, it spent a lot of time on the Hill, and then back in about sometime in the late 90s, when Buzz and I were back there, we actually put on a congressional hearing and looking at the future of NASA. It was there and we briefed it. And so it has got exposure on the Hill. This new version has not yet. I think it's inevitable it will, especially with all of the activity with the National Space Council. One of my early supporters was Scott Pace. Well, Scott and I and Dallas Beinhoff actually used to work in the Advanced Projects Group at Rockwell many years ago when this was all born. Of course, Scott is now the secretary of the new National Space Council, so I'm pretty sure it'll get there pretty soon.
Do you know of any people who get it and then take it over individually to their congressperson's office or regional office or local office? Have you gotten any reports like that?
I don't know, but I will be probably going to the next March storm, and maybe I should bring a whole bunch with me. Maybe we should start doing that. Of course, I'll be working on the space holiday, which maybe I could mention towards the end here. But yeah, I think that's, something, now that we've got an updated one, we should probably use it when we can on the Hill.
Why not? I mean,
I think that's a great idea, but also, I would presume that some of at least the staffers are going out to look at it because it's available online. In the old days, the physical copy was the only way that somebody could get it. Now, we have a pretty high volume of people going out every month to look at our page, to look at the plan, but we don't know who all those people are.
Do you maintain a mailing list where you can add staffers related to science and technology to it?
You're not really supposed to do unsolicited email So we don't really do that. We have some lists of people that have purchased plans in the past, that have, you know, worked with us on various things in the past. And I'm not sure really, you know, if there is a good mechanism to send email to congressmen. I think that really they prefer only to get email from, like, their own constituents. So, like, if you're in a different state than the person, I don't know that they really are looking to get your emails.
So get those of us in our states to forward your newsletter to our congressmen. Of course, when I send newsletters when I send email to our newsletter, I don't have any clue that it's even received. So, and some of them don't even give you an email address to use. They give you a form and limit your response to like 100 characters or something like that.
Well, you're using Constant Contact, aren't you?
Not for communicating to members of Congress on issues that I feel that are important, like health care or space or something like that. I don't have direct email addresses for them. It's almost impossible to get it. And if you go to their websites, and those that welcome email give you a form to use, but it limits your number of characters in your comment. So it wouldn't work for sending them or forwarding them a newsletter. And you don't usually get a response back other than your note has been received, thank you. And so for all you know, it gets tabulated and then trashed. So I don't think it's a very effective way unless you really know how to get to the key people.
You know, we have had some discussions about it, and I think that the proper recipients would be like the space staffers.
Probably, yeah.
Members. So I think that's probably what we will do, and again, that might tie in to the Apollo anniversary. We're expecting, you know, a whole lot of attention being paid to space overall next year in addition to the anniversary. So maybe that would be a good time to do it, as we'll have a fresh plan.
So my understanding for people who have gone either individually to Congress to call on representatives or to participate in March Storm or some of the other group lobbying efforts, when they meet with staffers, the staffers give them their business card and they give them their email addresses and say, you know, we'd be happy to receive further information from you on the topic or this or that or the other. So if you have participated in something like that and then you have made contact with these people, then they give you access to them. But it's pretty hard to just get it if you've never done that and you're just going to their websites to try to find out how to reach them.
I'm sure they get buried with tons of email all the time, so they have to control it somehow.
Oh, yeah, millions of them, I'm sure of it.
And I'm sure the guys at National Space Society, the policy people, Dale Scran, I'm sure he's got all the right emails, Jay.
I suspect that Dale does have them. Perhaps I could to do some outreach to him and see if that's public domain information or not to share.
Should be. Those are our paid representatives.
Public servants, after all.
Yeah. Not secret.
So, Ron, did you want to talk for a minute about the anniversary holiday idea? Because I want to talk about some of the future things for our website, but I want to make sure you have time to put that out there.
Sure. Just to give everybody kind of a little heads up on a recent activity that we're going to be really pushing. Now it looks like after the election, I started a little effort this summer after a discussion with my favorite old Apollo astronaut about, you know, why isn't July 20th a national holiday yet? So, you know, long story short, I actually wrote a bill to make July 20th a national holiday. And took it to my old former congressman, who Dana Rohrabacher, who is one of the most powerful congressmen on the Hill right now. He's the number two guy in the space science, science, space, and technology committee. Dana loved the bill. He agreed to sponsor it. And unfortunately, Dana is involved in a re-election campaign.
Yeah, fight for his life.
And, yeah, it's going to be he's in the fight of his life. So And it turns out politics on the Hill are just so divisive right now. We've decided that maybe it's best to resume this effort after the election, and we'll just see what happens. It's hard to believe that things are so divisive on the Hill that you can't get everybody to agree that July 20th, one of the great days in American history and in the world history, shouldn't be recognized as at least a non-paid holiday. But, yeah, there's a lot of politics involved. So, anyway, this is coming down the pike. The bill's been written. It's been through the lawyers, and it's just so it will be a focus this after the election. And we're hoping, I'm hoping Dana survives. And you know, we're come next March, we're adding sponsors to the bill. We're hoping to get the thing done and through both houses by July 20th. So when we have a little ceremony for the 50th anniversary in the Oval Office, this is something that the president can announce, that July 20th is a national holiday.
Do you know if the administration and the National Space Council support making it a national holiday? I don't know who would.
I'm told that the White House is very excited about it, that Dana's office is working it. They're aware of it, and they're excited about it. But they also got to contend with the politics of the time, too, so... we'll just see what happens. You know, the bill is written. It's there. It's
can we read it someplace? Is there a website for it, or is there a petition drive to?
Well, as a matter of fact, there is a website. If people want to read the bill, it's at spaceexplorationday.wordpress.com. Now, in the next few days, literally, by next week, it should be spaceexplorationday.space. We got this .space domain a month or so ago, but it takes time for it to kick in. But I think it's going to happen, like, literally this next week. But you can see it right now. You can read the bill, www.spaceexplorationday.wordpress.com. And there not only is there a bill, is the bill out there, but there's also a really neat walk down memory lane. We put together a kind of an expose, a photo expose of all the great iconic pictures from the summer of '69. That's out there. Plus, I did a deep dive into the background of Space Exploration Day, trying to get it passed. There's a 3,000 word essay out there on that that I wrote. And I think Janet Ivey is our web person. Janet's putting together the website. She's also working on a kind of a newspaper, front page newspaper clippings around the world. That's going to be on the website in the next week or so. And we're going to have a way that people can contact their congressman and senator to support the effort. So that'll be all on there in the next few weeks. But the website or development is out there, and people can go read the bill.
Are you going to do a WhiteHouse.gov petition for people to sign a petition to support it?
I don't want to say no. I haven't looked into that. I'm dealing with Congressman Rohrabacher's office. If he thinks that's a good idea, then we'll do it, and if not, we won't.
Because that would give the people a chance to support it, and if you get a lot of signatures, and I can't imagine you wouldn't, that would be ammunition to show to Congress and to people.
Yeah.
And it's free of charge. Always important in these events. Briefly, I've heard this for years and years since doing the space show. Is there a chief primary reason why it's never been done? Can you say this is the ultimate reason why it's not a national holiday, or is it just a complex bunch of crap that has gotten in the way of it?
Well, the problem with July 20th is we've always wanted to use it as a way to educate kids and get kids excited about space, but July 20th is in summertime, and most kids are out of school. And so it's not a real good time to do stuff for kids. And in the meantime, over the years, we've now got the UN involved, and there's in October, around the week of October 4th, around Sputnik, there's this International Space Week activities, and I think Dennis Stone and his organization in Houston kind of runs that. So that's definitely for kids, but it's in October. And the other great day for space is the International Day of Spaceflight, which the UN has proclaimed, and that's in April after Yuri Gagarin's flight. So, and that's also the time of Yuri's night, I guess. So there are other days that kids can get involved. So this time around we thought, well, you know, screw the kids. You know, this is something, you know.
Be careful there, Ron.
We Americans that lived through it, and, you know, we want to recognize this as one of the great days of the 20th century. Probably one of the greatest days in human history, and there should be some minimal recognition of it by the government.
Well, I'm on board completely. I totally agree with you, and I don't understand why it hasn't happened before, and especially if you got all these dates around Soviet Union events.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Jesus, come on. But look, they didn't even plant the flag in the new movie about Neil, which has caused a little consternation among some people, and people who acted in it and others don't think it has a lot to do with the United States, but all about humanity. So I don't know. I'm not of that school of thought, but I'm anxious to go see the film. When you have that kind of mentality and history being portrayed, I think it's pretty hard to have a day to honor what America did and Neil's words when he walked on the moon. It's long, long, long overdue, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
Well, in that essay that I wrote, I've said a little bit about over the years, you know, I've had many discussions with Buzz Aldrin about this, and he gets just frustrated. You know, he's a national hero who is upset that we haven't yet to recognize this great American event. And so hopefully we can do something about that. And if we can't do it by the 50th anniversary, you know, especially with the pro-space president and vice president and the new National Space Council pushing to go back to the moon and on to Mars, boy, if we can't make it happen now, it's, I don't know.
We ought to do it while Buzz and Mike are still with us. They're 88 years of age, and you know, Buzz is I've never met Mike Collins, and I've never talked to him, so I don't know how he's holding up and doing, but age does show up with Buzz a little bit.
Sure.
And he's a national hero, if you ask me, and to not have this day for July 20th, and it needs to be done while he is still around, in my opinion.
Well, if we can't get it for the 50-year anniversary, the next stop is 100, and none of us are going to be.
Well, we'll just have to do it for the 51st. I don't know. That's why I think if there was a petition drive and you know, a couple of 100,000 people maybe signed it, I think maybe a lot of people outside the space industry would sign it if we all got behind it and promoted it.
Well, that's a good suggestion, David. I haven't really even thought about that. I've been so...
I'll promote the hell out of it on the space show.
You could ask Howard Bloom about petitions. He could maybe tell you the process.
Well, I've had him on, and I know the process, but they've got their petition going to, you know, kill SLS Orion and LOP G. So that's a whole different ballgame. And the truth is, I don't think you want to associate the two together, because this cause is noble. And to a lot of people,
I'm not saying what the topic is, just the mechanics of running a petition.
Yeah, no, I think you just go to the petition page at whitehouse.gov, and their rules are really simple, and you write your statement as to what it is and put it up there and publicize the heck out of it.
Okay, well, that sounds straightforward enough.
And it is free. It's petitions at whitehouse.gov, and I support it, and I would, you know, support it on every single space show possible. I can't even think of a reason not to do it.
Yeah, well, it doesn't cost anything.
Having said that, David, I'll get right on that.
Yeah, and I mean, actually anybody could have gotten right on it, but it ought to be integrated into the bill that you have written and that Dana is gonna work for. And I don't know, maybe it would even help Dana in his campaign. I have no idea, but I think it should be done. It's a very important day for the world.
Well, the history is important, but I guess we're at the Integrated Space Plan headquarters, we're more interested in the future.
except for the fact that we're thinking about putting together an ISP of the past around the whole architecture build-up for the Apollo moon landing. So other than that, we're about the future.
That would actually be very interesting to show how we got to the moon from the starting point from Kennedy's speech to actually doing it. That would be a really interesting space plan flowchart.
About that a little bit, because that was part of what I wanted to say toward the end of the show, is like what's coming up for us. And we intend to do a Kickstarter campaign this coming year, toward the beginning of the year sometime, as part of our ongoing website enhancements and updating the posters and everything. And we have been talking about doing, in effect, an integrated space plan of the past, to sort of depict the early days of the space program, because the three of us on this call have a good idea of the early days of the space program, but I think a lot of the public really doesn't anymore. It's been a long time. So to show sort of the overview format that the Integrated Space Plan is famous for, of what big steps came between the late 50s and 1969, we think would be very interesting. So we're looking at that as maybe something to incorporate into our celebrations of the Apollo anniversary. And also, we want to do some new things with our online presence, partly because we feel like the clock speed of the whole space effort is just getting faster and faster with the more activity by the entrepreneurial commercial space firms, the new space firms. So some of the things that we're looking at doing is, in addition to the student version of our plan and the adult version of our plan, we're talking about having a new version that we have sort of a working title of professional mode. And what that would be is like a real-time thing that would look different, that would be updated constantly as opposed to being updated every other year. So what that would look like is different people in the space community would have like a login that they could go in there and they could suggest additions or changes to the plan, that then our team would go through all those and approve or disapprove those things, so that the plan would be changing on a pretty much constant basis, as opposed to the periodic updates that we've been doing. And some of the things that we would be able to incorporate into that would be to show like which elements in the plan are dependent on which other elements of the plan. So, for example, maybe you say that you have to have ice mining before you can have a big lunar base. So one would be dependent on the other to show all those things on the plan. We also want to have a consistent way of depicting the information when people click on an element. What we're looking at is a quad chart format like NASA uses, that there is a consistent way that the data is deployed when people click on an element to see things. Also, that you would be able to determine what the critical path is between different things. So going back to the lunar ice mining, for example, let's say that you wanted to have orbital fuel depots fueled out of ice mining on the moon. There's a bunch of steps in between there, so you could like pick out the two elements, and then the plan would like show you the path in between, like what would have to happen from one to the next one. And one of the other things is to be able to determine from some milestone that's achieved now, how far are you from X? So, for example, if you had a SpaceX BFR that was fully operational, how far are you now from having a big Mars base now that you've achieved that piece of the goal? So a lot of automation and a lot of instantaneous calculations for the online version and the ability for other people, other entities in the space arena to cooperate and participate more fully in what we're doing, as opposed to a semi-level of participation, which is what we've had so far. And if anybody wants to help any of these things happen, there are basically three areas that we could use help on. So if anybody listening to the space show is really good at PR, we'd like to talk to that person to see if they want to get involved to help us with that. The second thing is social media. If there's a person in the space community who's really good at social media, who's interested in what we're doing, the future in space, we'd like to hear from them. And the last category of things is computer Jedi. We need help on the computer side to help the team that we have right now, which is led by Michael Mealing at the moment. He could use a hand with some stuff. So if you are good at Python, if you are good at Angular, or you are good at D3, we want to hear from you. You can be a part of this building the future, sharing the future with everybody. And we'd love to add you to our group and build this together.
You guys have a phone call that I'm going to bring in. Hang on. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please? Where are you?
This is Doug from Southern California, and I wanted to ask about leapfrogging. And by this I mean where you may jump steps to achieve sort of a goal more quickly and without the intervening infrastructure. And what the reason why this comes to mind is because just right now I mentioned about maybe propellant depots and then ice mining or ice harvesting on the moon.
Yeah.
And that is sort of a logical thing to do. We had somebody on the show recently, Dallas Beanhoff, who suggested we'll first get the depots in place and then go to have telerobotic ice harvesters to go ahead and put propellant in the depot that could serve both cislunar space as well as missions to Mars. I'd like to suggest that there could be at times in which we might want to bypass an intermediate step. If you really wanted to go slow and in a very methodical sort of way, you could say, well, let's do nothing on the moon. Let's just develop LEO commercially first. And then only after we develop LEO commercially first, then we'll go ahead and develop a depot somewhere in cislunar space. And then after that, then let's go ahead and establish something in low lunar orbit. And after that, let's go ahead and do some prospecting on the moon until we find out, you know, a very extensive campaign to find out where the ice is. And then after that, do some small demonstrations. And then after that, you could imagine dividing the steps, you know, many times. However, what one could do is one can develop a full-size lander, send large-scale telerobots to the surface of the moon, harvest the ice and actually use the landers themselves as the storage tanks and essentially have a depot on the moon, and now you're going out to cislunar space and providing full-scale retrieval of cargo, crew, transferring propellant or providing propulsion services without developing LEO, without having a propellant depot at EML-1 or low lunar orbit. And obviously, the BFR totally bypasses all sorts of intermediate steps. They don't talk about, depots anywhere. You know, they're just going straight to the moon and to Mars. So how can your plan sort of take into account that there might be, strategies that bypass the intermediate steps?
Well, you win the complicated question of the day award, I think.
yeah.
Well,
It's not really that complicated. You just put them all on. you include as much as you can, which also includes the approaches you're not going to go. That aren't going to happen. So we're trying to include all those types of things. Adding the BFR.
I agree with what Ron said, in that we're trying to show something, Doug, that's robust, that has multiple paths, and we feel like that's appropriate. We have a whole bunch of different Earth-to-orbit launch vehicles on the plan, and you could certainly say, well, half of these aren't necessary, but you do want redundancy, you want different companies, you want different approaches. So what you're saying about the BFR is very true, that if BFR fulfills all the projections and all the hopes, rapidly other things, some of the things that are on the plan, will become less and less relevant if the BFR is reliable and flies often and does what we're expecting. But things do have setbacks, things are delayed, and it's good to have a robust system with more than just, we don't want any single point failures in it.
So as the reader is looking at the plan, does the reader get the impression that all of these steps are necessary, or is it obvious to the reader that there could be some leapfrogging involved?
Well, let me answer that. There could be leapfrogging involved, whether or not it's obvious to the reader or not. In the old days, you probably didn't see the original plan back in the 90s, but I had everything connected, and everything that was connected to everything else was connected. So if something didn't happen, you just follow some other connection path to get to where you wanted to go. Well, we haven't done that yet, and that's what Jay was talking about doing on a later version, where we show all these connections between the elements. So land your whole depot on one fell swoop on a lander and use that, you want to have that on there, but you might also have a fuel depots showing somewhere in cislunar space, but you can do it. So if you eliminate one or the other, you could still achieve what you want to achieve through the other path. Now the time frames might be a little screwy, but yeah, we'd like to be able to include all those types of paths on there. That's the integrated part of the integrated space plan.
Well, Doug, one example might be something that you and I have talked about before, is that, I have a position or an opinion that it's good to have something out by the moon where lunar landers could be based and refueled and serviced and everything, so that there's sort of a way station. In our case, at L1, we like that better than the LOP G location. And you've given the example of, like, if somebody is doing the run and you pass the baton from one to another, you don't really need an intermediary. So there are things like that in the plan that it's possible people might choose to bypass. So, yeah, there are steps that could be jumped over, and it will just have to be determined at the time whether that's the opinion of everybody, that it's good to jump over them, or if the extra redundancy is worth having.
Well, I don't think jump over is really an accurate way to look at it. We can't, as hard as we're trying, we can't predict the future. We don't know what Blue Origin guy is going to, pull out of his hat, kind of like Elon does. So we just need to include as many of these different opportunities for expansion on the plan as we can, and some things will happen and some won't, and we'll get there one way or the other because the endpoints aren't going to change. But the architectures that we eventually use, those might, might not be as obvious, but they're on there.
Yeah, well, thanks for the question. That's pretty bad choice.
Doug, come about from different players. Like we, some of our people are the founders of Starbridge Venture Capital, and they are looking at different investment opportunities in the space realm. So we want to show, what we think is possible in the future, so that all the people that are in that space can look at what timing we think is reasonable for things to happen, what we think might happen, and how the different things relate to each other. But having said that, it's true that not all the things will actually occur. There's no way to know that for sure. So we think that that we're seeing a big investment opportunity in space, and that there's lots of different players that are involved in that. And that's part of what we're trying to show and reflect in the interrelationships between the different blocks of the integrated space planet, which blocks provide services and which blocks purchase services, and when those things happen, because that's part of enabling the capital pathways that are needed.
Can I ask you guys your opinions on beyond low Earth orbit, what you personally think would be sort of the real revenue generator?
I think there's a bunch of different ones.
What do you think will be the top?
One of them is ice.
Mining water, if you're talking cislunar space.
Propellant.
But that's a secondary purpose. What market would the ice serve?
A propulsion throughout the solar system. And water for drinking, washing, chemistry, agriculture. You know, water has a million uses.
So propulsion services.
And life support. And industry.
Okay, well, thanks for answering my question.
Thank you, Doug, for your call. Appreciate hearing from you.
Sure thing.
You know,
go ahead.
And one other thing to consider is that every day that passes, we're a day closer to the eventual singularity that we all hear so much about. And that just makes things so much more difficult to predict. I mean, it's not easy predicting a future. It never was. But the closer we get to the singularity, the more difficult it's going to be. So that's our challenge.
Guys, we're past the normal closing time of the show. Do you want to give us closing comments? Have we forgotten to talk about something that you want to talk about? Should we add something different that has been omitted? Maybe I didn't even know that I was omitting something, but you have something more to say, or do you have takeaways or something you want to share with us?
Ron, why don't you go ahead?
Well, I had a good time. I think we've covered most of the things I thought we might cover. Just stay tuned for the next generation of the chart, and maybe a generation about the past. And we have a good time doing it. I hope we can begin to start integrating some other other thoughts from folks out there in the community, get them involved in future generations of the chart here, and hopefully in the not too distant future.
Okay, Jay, how about you?
Well, I too enjoyed our conversation. I was surprised to find how long it had been since we've been on the program. We are excited about the Apollo anniversary. We think there's going to be a lot more focus and interest in what's going on in space and what we've already accomplished and where we're going. And we think that what we're putting together and what we offer is a good plan for the future. And I guess what I'd put out to the audience is once again, if you're good at public relations, social media, or Python, Angular, or D3, we'd really like to talk to you. We're trying to put together something that's very interesting and make it more compelling and more real time, because it's going to be necessary as things accelerate in the coming years. So if you're interested, you can reach me through our website. Or you can send me an email if you want at jwittner@gmail.com.
Okay, and I will look forward to talking to you both again and staying up on your changes and the evolution. And I'm really interested in the past and in the changing for the space law for July 20th and any petition you might do. So don't forget us, and I'll be happy to keep bringing this stuff up on the space show.
Thank you, David.
Thank you both for coming back on the air. It's always great to hear from you, and all the best for the rest of the weekend. Listeners, thank you for your emails. Doug, for your phone call. a full week on the space show coming up, so check the newsletters that are already published and available. And everybody have a great week. Mars is still visible if you have been lazy and not looking at it. You can still see it. So for me, it's a little beyond west now. It's probably getting into the tiny range of northwest, and it is a lot dimmer, but there's no mistaking that it is Mars. And I see it every single night, and you can too, and you should. So everybody have a great week going forward, and thanks again to Jay and Ron for a most interesting space show update. Everybody have a great week, and goodbye from Jay, Ron, and David.